Treat Dad this Father's Day with great gifts from Menards. From levels, nailers, and drills to complete any project, to tool chests, recliners, and grills, we've got the perfect gifts to make this Father's Day one to remember. Stop by your local Menards today and save big money on gifts for Dad. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
This week on Lunchbox Envy, the Tudors served up a pigeon inside a partridge, inside a chicken, inside a goose, inside a turkey.
Queen Victoria's featured calf's head soup and pheasant in macaroni.
Captain Scott's expedition to the South Pole had to resort to a main course of stewed penguin.
And in the Czech Republic, traditionally, there must be an even number of people around the table. Otherwise, the odd person out will die within the year. Which is why I'm here.
It's Christmas! Woo-hoo! Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Jack and I'm here with my fellow QI elf, Manu.
Hey.
Our resident chef and food writer, Rosie.
I'm back, baby.
Yeah, welcome back. It's lovely to have you. It feels
Wait,
like old times.
What's the Die Hard quote? Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Because it's Christmas, we've got our producer, Alex, as well.
Merry Christmas.
Yay.
Should we have some champagne?
Yeah.
Cheers,
cheers,
guys.
Woo.
You are the most Christmassy person I know.
For me?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I do go quite hard for Christmas. We used to have these really big Christmas dinners when Jack and I lived together.
Yeah.
And we'd make a really long table.
Yeah.
We'd have like 20 people around. Mm-hmm. We live with chefs as well,
yeah,
which is great.
The other
so
thing.
I sort of really put them to work and made them like...
Yeah, because one year I was just like roped in to cook this Christmas dinner that I definitely not agreed to do.
I'm acutely aware I'm sitting next to an absolute Scrooge.
Ebenezer McKean.
I am the Scrooge at this table. I don't think Christmas lunch is a good lunch.
listen.
I'm all for family togetherness. I'm all for having a delicious meal, one and all. But if I'm going to push the boat out, there's one meal that I don't want to make, and it's a shitting roast.
That's true.
Because a roast is one of our worst meals.
Yeah.
I'm going to cop some
heat
for this.
No, I aggressively disagree with you. Sorry.
I know I'm going to cop some heat for this.
Well, let's have a proper debate when we get into it, I think, because I certainly think Rosie needs to stand trial for some rule for this.
Listen, I've been consistent in my views for years. I think it's also when I was working as a food stylist, you do Christmas from about July onwards.
The same in television, like you're
exactly.
doing the middle of the year.
Any media, Christmas happens 6 months before it actually happens. Mm-hmm. So you get quite sick of it. But also if you've cooked it 18 times by the time you get to Christmas and then you are... There's maybe some weighted therapy issues here that I need to discuss. But like, you're the person who cooks Christmas dinner and you have to cook the same fucking thing.
Yeah. And then your friends invite you round and then make you cook it like I
yeah,
did.
Yeah. And then everyone's just got an opinion on it. Like, anyway, we'll talk about it.
I think universally though, eating a lot of food, that's like... We all enjoy that,
yeah.
no matter
yeah,
what course. It is.
It's been a feast tradition since Neolithic times, actually. I read that archaeologists digging near Stonehenge found a huge mountain of pig bones.
I think you're going to say like a huge pile of Ferrero Rocher wrappers.
No, they're buried a bit deeper. They didn't find them. And they also managed to work out that the bones were about 9 months old. So if the piglets were being born in spring, they'd have been eating it at Christmas. So it's the first documented sort of, pre-Christ, but it was like a midwinter feast that the Brits were all having 4,000 years ago.
Yeah, what did they call it?
Just mus.
Happy
stone mus.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because like for many of us, it's quite secular now, Christmas. Like, it's
yeah,
just
I think so.
This point at the end of the year where you absolutely send it on the food and drink. 100%. And it's like, do we need that collectively as a society? Like something to look forward to where you can just be like, it's okay because at Christmas I'm going to lose
I think
mind.
So.
Well,
I think
cultures have the like midwinter when it's dark and it's bleak. You want light, you want loads of food, you want candles.
Very true.
Something to look forward to as well.
Exactly. Going back to the food then, I think about 89% of the UK celebrate Christmas.
Right.
Well, there is a YouGov poll on what constitutes a Christmas dinner.
Okay. This was the one for this year, 2025,
exactly.
Right? Because it's the Christmas special. We want to start with cold, hard data.
To start with, only 8 in 10 Britons, this is actually shocking to me, will be accompanying their Christmas Day meal with roast potatoes or gravy.
That is unbelievable.
That is actually crazy to me. Why are you not having potatoes and why are you not having gravy?
Well, this isn't, it says roast potatoes. Are they having another kind of potatoes?
Yeah, because I reckon most of the final 2 out of 10 are having boiled potatoes.
Or mashed potatoes as well. I think maybe in the Midlands it's chips. A lot more common.
Like as a fundamental Christmas food Scrooge, those are the 2 bits that I think are the most important.
That's true.
Like, if I am going to have Christmas dinner, the 2 bits I'm not missing are the potatoes and gravy.
Also, I definitely prefer of the meats the pigs in blankets. Like that's just like triggers your like animal brain.
Do you
like,
make your own? Do you wrap your own?
My grandma used to make them, but
Oh, what was the word for wrapping stuff in bacon we learned?
Oh, barding.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're just barded sausages, aren't they?
Do you bard your own sausage?
I don't bard them, I do sparge them.
Okay, so let's go through vegetables, most common to least common, not including potatoes, I've already said that.
Yeah.
Okay.
What do you think is the next most popular vegetable?
Parsnips.
Carrots or parsnips are the big 2. I think parsnips also, like, I love parsnips. They look too similar to roast potatoes. So you have to be very careful about how you cut them and how they look. Because what you don't want is a load of beige things and then you have no idea whether you're biting into a parsnip
or
a
potato. Expecting it. It's nothing worse.
So it's a huge problem. Alex was right. It is carrots. And actually, parsnips aren't even the next popular
one. Oh, okay. Brussels sprouts.
Must be sprouts.
Is
sprouts.
Peas a thing?
Actually, only a third of Britons include peas in their
That's about what I'd expect.
And about a quarter include broccoli. Sorry, 4 in 10. What's that? A fourth?
40%. Nearly
40%,
half.
40%, nearly half. So that's not a quarter.
I'm not really learning much about vegetables, but I am learning that Rosie can't do maths.
Okay, what do we think about cauliflower cheese?
I think any of the tree vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower.
It's not. There's enough trees in Christmas
It's not Christmas.
The next 2 sides I'm going to mention have kind of got the least popularity, but I'm actually quite surprised by that because I'm always with given them growing up, which are red cabbage bread sauce. Which, by the way, I hate.
Who invented bread sauce? What were you trying to do?
Very old-fashioned porridge.
It was definitely beaten. Surely it was beaten. She was like, what to ruin a loaf of bread? I think it looks like something a pigeon would eat. I will just say I missed this bit. Mashed potato does feature for 35% of Brits.
Oh, wow. So there's an overlap. So
but
some people
is,
are having...
It is very geographically dependent.
Yeah. So some people are having roast potato and mashed potato. Yeah.
Which is so valid.
80% plus 35% does not equal 100%.
Whoever said it was the Northerners, they were right. 50% of them will have mashed potato.
Yeah, I think so. One of the last things in the poll was, which emotions do you typically feel over the Christmas period? And from top to bottom, from 59% to 3, is happy, nostalgic, joyful, relaxed, excited, content, stressed, sad, anxious, bored, lonely, frustrated, and other. I want to know what other is.
Yeah, yeah. The horny.
Horny.
I didn't want to admit it.
Clinically insane.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Okay, it's time for lunchbox number 1, and this week that is Rosie's.
guys, I hate to break it to you, but I don't have any of a Christmas dinner. And I didn't even cook it. What I have got for you today is a Japanese classic Kentucky Fried Chicken.
KFC, yes.
Oh my God, on a huge, beautifully presented, wow. I have to say.
Come on, Lee.
It's gorgeous.
It's like an advert. Pitching for that KFC food styling job.
It's on a beautiful Christmassy red tray. Mm. We've got a massive bucket of chicken. We've got fries in a platter. We've got sweet corn. We've got sauces.
Okay, did you know that in Japan, KFC is the most eaten Christmas dinner?
What? Oh.
This is like a huge tradition over there, right?
It's a huge tradition. So it's basically one of Japan's most successful pieces of Christmas marketing.
Okay. Mm.
And it dates back to the 70s when Takeshi Okawara, the manager of the first KFC in Japan in Nagoya, noticed that foreigners who were in the country at the time were looking for a traditional Christmas meal.
Okay.
But with not really any Christmas food culture in Japan, he improvised with a party barrel. Of fried chicken as a substitute for a Western style turkey dinner.
Yeah.
Ah.
And then KFC Japan in 1974 launched a campaign called, oh good, here we go. This is good. My best Japanese. Kurisumasu Niwa Kentucky. Kurisumasu. Oh my God, it makes me
I can hear it. Christmas. Yeah. Kentucky Fried Christmas.
Yeah.
Sorry, by the way, for butchering that.
So it started off with this one manager of the KFC having this idea, and it was popular, and then KFC, the company got on board and were let's push this.
KFC head office loved it. And of course, because in Japan, Christmas is entirely secular, it basically became a new tradition, the perfect contest for a treat. Rather than anything religious.
Traditions have to start somewhere, don't they? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that Japanese people like think of it as a proper Japanese tradition. They don't think of it as like an American import.
Mm. Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's like become their thing.
Yeah. It's really ingrained in the culture. So today, 3.5 to 4 million Japanese families order a KFC at Christmas. They have to pre-order it. And apparently some KFC branches have queues round the block on the 24th and the 25th to pick up your order.
Amazing. God, KFC must be loving that.
Yeah, I reckon Burger King are kicking themselves.
The colours are quite Christmassy. Looking at the bucket.
You know, that's true.
It's an inherently celebratory meal at KFC because it's very much sharing oriented, which is what sets it apart from the other high street food, fast food ventures, I would say, is that it's about sharing. And
that's so true. The bucket is such a... Yeah. The true spirit of Christmas is in a bucket.
Let's discuss working together. The reason why I brought it is obviously because, as you know, I don't respect the Christmas tradition at all.
And this will be your last episode.
My first back and my last ever. I wanted to bring another option, another celebratory meal that doesn't actually have to be this down the line, boring as hell meal. As a chef, it appalls me.
Yeah.
It appalls me. It makes my skin crawl. You are making a meal which is so not synergetic. Uh-huh. You've got a turkey. Yes, sure. If you're clever enough, you'll make a gravy from your turkey. But quite a lot of people don't. So they've made a separate gravy. Mm-hmm. They've separately made roast potatoes. They've separately made parsnips, carrots, whatever. Everything is cooked apart.
Think
about how often that happens.
You don't have to cook them all apart, but you can put all the vegetables together.
Yeah, but for a perfect roast, there is actually quite a lot of precision and finesse needed. Everything has to be prepped separately.
What if you could order Christmas dinner like you could order KFC? Would you hate it less?
I still think it's the same problem of like, this meal doesn't make sense to me on the plate to have that many different elements all separate.
It's true. Yeah. So when you say that, there's actually so many different bits of the meal.
It's literally like, if you're doing it really big, you know, you've got six different sides, not including meat sides.
That is weird.
Two to three sauces, cranberry bread and gravy. What? That's insane.
But that's the point. The point is that it's a special meal. You'd never do this any other time.
Exactly. If I want to have a special meal, I'm not eating this. Like, I have been desperate to do a very seafood Christmas for years, where I would have like a big raw feast of like amazing shellfish.
It's very Italian.
Oysters. And then I would definitely do like a big fresh batch of like lobster or scallop or prawn linguine with like piles and piles of clams and whatever as well. By the way, does anyone want to eat some KFC?
Yes, I do.
Let's dig in.
Oh my God. Thank you, Rosie.
There's some dips and gravy, as you know.
Oh, damn.
I mean, I guess that I don't agree with your position, but I understand why you take that position now, because I think you're a cook and a chef. If you want to eat something, you want to eat it well. I guess maybe a roast is very easy to do, but very difficult to do like properly and well to your high standards.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's always going to be something that's shit. At least one thing has to suffer for the benefit of something else. Mm. And also the other thing that I fundamentally disagree with is turkey. Like, I don't think it's a good meat. I'm never going to be convinced on this. It's really hard to do well. I have eaten one good turkey dish in my life.
Wow.
Who was it?
And it was in like a really, really smart restaurant in Portugal. Mm. And they did like a tasting menu. To cook a turkey well, you need to take the legs off, braise them separately. You need to roast the crown. You need to have dry brined it for like X amount of days. And it still almost always is going to be dry as fuck. Mm. Unless you've got like a really amazing professional oven, like a Rationale, which they have in, you know, very smart kitchens.
What about the deep fried turkey?
I've never had it and I would try it because I really like deep frying as a medium. You are much more likely to get a moist result from deep frying than you are from ovening. Right. And then that's the other thing. The oven. The poor fucking oven. The oven is abused at Christmas because everything is roasted, which is why I advocate for like a gratin, which can be made well in advance and almost just shoved under a grill. Or, you know, even just done stovetop, like cheesy leeks. You could just do that on the top. You don't have to do that in the oven at all. Red cabbage, same thing. Like, all these little wet sides are much better than having three sauces and a shitload of dried out, poorly roasted potatoes, carrots and parsnips.
Well, Christmas is a time for differing opinions and having arguments with people. But I would say, I think I'd rather you be racist. I'd rather you be the racist uncle than be going
on
this
rant.
She
hates turkey.
I actually can't stomach it at all.
Thing is, I do cook it. Because my family, specifically my younger brothers, request it. Mm. But I would never cook a turkey, so I always do like a porchetta, usually, or a big four rib of beef.
Mm. Well, you're not the only one who doesn't like cooking turkeys. Did you know that Benjamin Franklin nearly killed himself in 1750 trying to electrocute a turkey for his Christmas dinner? It's so ridiculous. So he set up this experiment using these large Leyden jars, which are basically like early batteries, these big jars of liquids for storing electrical charge. And he tried to cook the turkey from live to plate. Okay.
Oh my God.
Electric chair.
So much wrong with that.
He believed
Wait, turkeys often get pardoned. This one had been condemned.
No, yeah. It was pretty savage. His belief was that the turkey would be more tender if I cooked it straight from alive. Mm. But during the demonstration, which he was doing in front of people, he accidentally discharged the full charge through his own body. It's like something out of Mr. Bean.
Oh my God.
It's also so funny that he was like, I've never done it before, but I'll demonstrate confidence, honestly.
So he accidentally managed to cook himself instead of the turkey. God. And he said that it struck him like a universal blow from head to foot. And his hands and his arms and his neck were all numb and aching until the next day. He sort of desperately asked that nobody make it public that this happened.
Here
we're talking
about
it now, so it kills somebody who eats it.
How embarrassing, Franklin.
The turkey survived.
Really?
Yeah.
Karma.
It reminds me a little bit of, so in food styling, we often use a heat gun when we are making things look bubbly for camera or like just very concentrated browning. So turkeys, as I have said, are very hard to cook well. But I'm sure you've seen a million beautifully bronze golden turkeys on all of the Christmas advertising that we get fed since, you know, September. Well, the secret to a perfectly golden turkey is Marmite.
That's a good one.
You just paint it on.
So basically what you'll do, firstly, you'll stuff the cavity with a mixture of kitchen towel and mashed potato.
Okay.
Because one of the big problems with turkey is when it roasts, it caves, you know, you suddenly get that spine that's way more visible. Yeah. Whereas when you see those turkeys in, you know, adverts, they're really like fast, juicy.
Plump. I'm sorry, where does kitchen paper and mashed potato rank on the YouGov survey?
Can I ask why both? Why not just one?
Yeah, that's good.
Because I think kitchen paper soaks up the excess liquid in the cavity and that comes
and
from
in the potatoes.
And the mash firms up. Solidifies. I basically can't style anything without kitchen towel. Then, depending on what your brief is, so let's say you do have to get a clean slice out of the breast.
Yeah.
You'll probably maybe even do like a few kettles of water over the top just to get those few outer layers nice and ready for cooking. And then also you'll bake it for as long as you need the breast to be just enough cooked to get that perfect slice.
Got it.
But you're really
steamy slice.
This is not for eating, this turkey. No oven has even heat, unless it's like brand new. Most ovens have hot spots and cold spots.
Yeah.
Most turkey skins have thick bits and thinner bits. So there's just no way that you can evenly brown a turkey perfectly for the standard of like commercial advertising that they require. So what you do is you take Marmite and you take a bit of washing up liquid.
Cool.
Because washing up liquid, for some reason, is a really good way of making it really spreadable.
What colour fairy?
Yeah, you don't want green or blue.
What? Oh. Yeah, you can't see it.
Yeah, and they also don't sell brown washing up liquid, do they?
No, yeah.
That would be really helpful. Then you could do away with it, aren't
I? So you mix it up and you basically just paint your skin of your turkey.
Mm.
And it also, the washing up liquid helps it stay really shiny as well. Like the gloss remains. When you see those turkeys, they're not matte, are they?
No,
they're just really shiny. The other problem you have, and the reason why we don't cook it through, is because the skin shrinks on turkeys. Mm. Or any poultry, when you roast poultry, the skin will shrink away. Sometimes you'll get little tears or pulls, and obviously that's going to be a big no for whoever it is.
Oh, yeah, consistency.
Yeah. So
it's ironic because all the human actors will be Botox to fuck. So.
And also, of course, obviously in big commercial ads and food styling, you will be roasting maybe 10 or 12, sometimes up to 20 turkeys for one shot.
Wow.
Because...
It's like my Christmas dinner.
Because obviously just to get a perfect, consistent result every single time, you have to be, you have to have a lot of turkeys on options, set. Yeah.
Maybe Benjamin Franklin's method would be useful for that, because you can put all the turkeys in a line and then just attach jumper capers.
Christmas lights, but
so that's what we do.
So turkey's off the menu, roast's off the menu. What around the world, what are the other options for traditional dinners then?
Well, fish is a really popular choice.
Okay.
In a lot of Catholic countries, or ex-Catholic countries, even if they've gone secular, because Catholics love a fast, we know.
What, fasting over Christmas, really?
No, but Advent period, fasts where you couldn't eat meat, but Catholics didn't consider fish as meat because it lives in the sea.
It is, of course, a vegetable of the sea.
Exactly.
Vegetable of the sea.
So fish, go for it. And this was like even up until Christmas Eve, which is why in a lot of these countries, the Christmas Eve meal is still fish.
Yeah.
But that's when like the big celebration is.
Often freshwater fish. Like I associate Polish Christmas with carp.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Is there
I've ever eaten carp.
It's horrible. It's called, sorry, no offense, Poland. But,
no offense to the fish community listening.
But carp has like shitloads of really tiny bones in it. It's almost it's quite like fluffy texture.
Crunchy.
Quite muddy as well. If you don't, like, you got to purge it. So there's a really cool tradition in the Czech Republic where it's not loads of families do it anymore. They tend to just go to a fishmonger. But some still do this. They'll buy their carp fresh, live, a couple of days before, pop it in the bath.
Oh, yeah.
So all of that mud comes out and you have a pet for a couple of days. Looks great fun. Can't have a bath.
And then you get Benjamin Franklin around to electrocute it.
And then you kill it on Christmas Day and you fry it and you eat it with potato salad and it looks amazing.
Bet you love that, Rosie.
I would actually eat the shit out of that. Yeah, I honestly rate the fish vibe on Christmas. As I said, I want a fish dinner.
Mm-hmm.
But my brothers don't eat fish, so we've never been allowed it. And that is why I don't speak to them anymore.
Your brother's food taste and mine align very nicely. I think I should have Christmas with them.
Yeah, that's why you're such good mates with them.
Yeah, yeah. That's why we keep hanging out without you.
So there's another community that gets takeout on Christmas Day.
Yes.
You know it.
Yeah. Jewish New Yorkers. Is it just New York or is it all over the States?
Yeah.
Will enjoy a Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Christmas Day.
Because they're not celebrating Christmas. That's the only place that's open.
Also, they want to do something special. And I think a lot of Chinese food is kosher as well.
Well, also, I imagine that the Chinese community in New York are still running their businesses on Christmas Day because they're not celebrating Christmas either.
Yeah.
So they're probably one of the only restaurants that was open, like historically, that they could get food from. Maybe.
I think it's the same here, like, you know how, because there's a lot of people go out to have their Christmas dinner, you can book at a restaurant or a pub, but there's loads of like international food options, like Indian and stuff like that, because
Christmas curry.
It's not
we had Indian Christmas last year.
Did you?
Yeah. with my husband's Jewish family.
Hey, what's the most Christmassy curry?
See, I would suggest in Lapland.
Famous for its curry, Lapland.
Yeah. No, this isn't a curry, but this might make a good meat for a curry. Uh-huh. So like around Lapland, which is that sort of area across Norway, Sweden, Finland, they will eat reindeer.
Oh.
Which is maybe the most / least Christmassy spirit thing.
Yeah, true, actually.
At the same time.
I thought the reindeer were otherwise engaged on Christmas.
Yeah, exactly.
They needed to keep...
I don't think they all are. They're only about...
The weak ones that can't fly.
The ones that fall behind, yeah.
I will say there is one Christmas traditional meat that I am a million percent a fan of.
Oh, yeah?
Ham.
Oh, yeah.
The ham.
The Christmas ham.
The Christmas ham. That is... worth having all year round, in my opinion. Nice ham in your fridge.
I agree.
Why not? Why don't we do that?
In Antarctica, specifically in 1902, Shackleton's expedition to the South Pole, he hid a Christmas pudding from his team and he went and found it on Christmas Day and it was wrapped up in some socks. He'd hidden it in a pile of socks. And then in 1912, there was an Australasian expedition which failed to make it to the South Pole, but they, this is really tragic, they had to create a Christmas pudding out of 3 ground-up hardtack biscuits mixed with snow and 7 raisins and then doused in methylated spirits and boiled in an old sock.
Oh, my God.
And they ate that.
And they ate that. Okay, it's time for lunchbox number 2, and this week that is mine. I've brought you a mince pie.
Oh.
And it's rather large, which is how they used to make it back in the day. So I followed a 1798 recipe.
You had me at mince pie until you said the recipe from 1798.
So interestingly, it's actually got meat in it.
Oh, God, like actual mincemeat.
Yeah, actual mincemeat. And also some suet, which obviously you can get vegetarian versions of these days. That is beef fat. Which is solid at room temperature, adds to the richness of pastries.
Mm. So is the suet in the pastry or in the filling?
It's in the filling.
Mm. Is the pastry lard-based?
No, well, the original recipe said yes, but I thought I'd spare you all that extra meat. And wow. I made it with butter.
Okay. Thank you for that.
But I'm not a baker, as I've often said on this podcast, but I do think the pastry mix is particularly puritanical and stodge-free. But it's basically just flour and water and some butter. And that's actually how they used to be made. Like, pastry used to be a form of Tupperware. It was a storage method, so you'd often tear open your pie and throw away the pastry because it didn't taste of anything. It was quite hard.
That's so interesting.
And apparently if you covered up the air holes with some solid fat, like lard, for instance, you could keep them for up to a year.
Whoa.
Wow.
Because the ingredients were cooked inside and salty and sugary enough that they didn't
basically
ferment.
So you'd make your mince pies the year before you wanted to eat them?
But this is pies generally. So I do a little bit of history of mince pie?
Let's hear it, yeah. I'm in no rush to tuck in, thanks.
Wow, rude. So,
pie crusts used to be known as coffins.
Because people were coughing in them?
Yeah, well, no, because they look like coffin-shaped and they used to store...
Okay, so that's why you've made this one in like a big rectangular shape.
Yeah,
massive,
so basically this one looks like... Yeah, I've made it in a loaf tin because the other thing they used to do is make the mince pies not only enormous, but in the shape of the baby Jesus' manger.
Aww. Wow.
And also traditionally made with 13 ingredients to represent Christ and his apostles.
Oh.
So heavily religious. But yeah, so the earliest recipe we have is from the cookbook from the 14th century called The Form of Curry, which was basically, I think it was a royal court wrote down a list of all the recipes they made for the king.
But it's spelled like the formy of curry.
Yeah,
like,
it's very old English.
Yeah, like, yeah. Ooh, you imagine it in spindly writing.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a spell book.
Yeah. Anyway, they give a recipe for tart of flesh, again with an E on the end.
Fix your branding.
Yeah.
Which contains figs, raisins, wine, pine kernels, lard, cheese, minced pork, honey and spices.
Mm.
So it's kind of the earliest pork pie.
It's kind of like a potpourri pork pie.
Is this the same recipe that I've got in my notes? It also includes hard-boiled eggs.
Oh, no, I don't think so.
That's another rogue thing. And cheese.
Very sulfuric combinations there.
Yeah. But no, I made this one. This one dates to a bit later, but it's essentially a tart of flesh. So,
lovely.
Do you want to tuck in?
I like a modern mince pie, shall we say. And I also like a meat pie. So there's a part of me that's like, it should work.
And it's got genuine spices. I think basically the combination of eating meat and spices arrived in this country after the Crusades because it was quite popular in the Middle East and has been for many centuries. Samuel Pepys had mince pies a little bit later at a friend's anniversary party in 1661. And there are apparently 18 mince pies, one for each of their year of their happy marriage. But he also does seem to expect them for Christmas because his wife got too ill to make them one year. So instead of making them himself, he just got them delivered.
Like the birth of delivery. Yeah,
exactly. I wonder if they were made in the bakery in Pudding Lane.
Actually caused the Great Fire.
Yeah, they might have been.
So I can go through the ingredients. It's basically mince, grated apple, suet, raisins, cinnamon, nutmeg, cloves, a bit of ginger, and some apple juice just to keep it moist.
Look, that doesn't seem like that wouldn't not be in an Ottolenghi cookbook at some point.
Like, negatives, yeah.
Sorry to use so many double negatives.
With the medieval spice combination, something Ken Albala brought up when we were doing Thanksgiving, he brought up the fact that that combination is pumpkin spice. So like everything from that period tended to
be this actually
spice.
We talked about pumpkin spice spam. This is basically a pumpkin spice spam pie. In case you're wondering when the meat got dropped, it was sometime in the 19th century because we've got Mrs. Beaton, friend of the pod. She wrote in her book of household management two recipes, one with meat and one without. And then by the 20th century, there was no meat, really, unless you were doing an old school one.
Well, should we dig into this?
Okay.
It's got a good...
It's just really quite hard.
Do you want to hands it?
Oh, no. It is just a meat pie, Anna.
Are you going to go in for a big...
I'm going to go for
it. It's a big spoon.
You can't really taste the meat.
Really?
It's just like a mince pie.
It's not...
Well, yeah, it tastes so much like a... normal mince pie.
I think if I didn't know the beef was in there, I'd prefer it. I mean, I think the problem I have with it is that I just want it to be more savoury, not sweet.
Yeah, pick a lane.
Pick a lane.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Because I love mince pies.
People think I'm mad for doing this.
Okay.
Mince pie in the oven. Take it out of the oven. Take the top off. Layer of butter.
Interesting.
Because it's not decadent enough.
I'm going to try that. That's actually clever.
Very good.
It's like a piece of toast, except for the toast is
a mince pie.
Well, it's essentially you're buttering something.
You say that whenever you put butter on your boiled potatoes. It's like toast.
Yeah, it's just like a piece of toast.
Or like when you're like moisturising in the evening. It's like I'm a piece of toast.
No, I don't think you're mad. I think that's actually really,
that sounds
really,
really
clever. I would order that in a restaurant if it was on a menu.
In Yorkshire, they still eat them with cheese.
Yeah, like a mince steak.
Yeah, basically. Wait, like a little bit of quite subtle, like Wensleydale or Cheshire
say
cheese.
Cheddar in a mince pie.
Sometimes cheddar.
Well, speaking of Yorkshire, should we move on to Yorkshire puddings?
Oh my god, sorry. The best part of the roast, Rosie.
Just so disagree. Like, why am I eating a dry AF pancake?
No, because you're making them. Okay, no, they're
I have to ask this. How many households consider Yorkshire pudding part of the Christmas
Well,
lunch?
Firstly, everyone in Yorkshire, surely.
Oh, maybe. Actually, I don't have geographical data.
I would say 30% of the population.
I think it's got to be more. I think it's got to be like 50 or 60.
I think it's less because it is non-traditional.
Rosie's closest. Woo! It's 49% of Britons add Yorkshire pudding. It's basically Brexit. It's basically referendum. And I do wonder whether it's everyone who voted Remain.
Imagine if it went straight down the party lines.
Yeah. 49% of Britons add Yorkshire puddings to their table. This rises to 68% when people have roast beef.
I can understand. The Yorkshire pudding is actually, as opposed to a lot of the other components of a stupid Christmas roast, makes sense to me when it's beef because traditionally you use beef dripping, the to make fat the... from the beef that you're cooking to cook your Yorkshire puddings in, and that is synergetic cooking. That's like, and this is in this. So we use that as well.
Also, you could cook them in the dripping, but not in the classic shape. So you could put like little dollops in your fat. Okay. And those were called Yorkshire puffs.
Excuse me?
So A woman called Hannah Glass was the first to write about them in the UK.
Okay.
She was a chef from the 1700s, and she mentions them in her book, The Art of Cookery, Made Plain and Easy.
I thought that that's where she popularised her recipe. Yeah. But I think that she actually first printed the recipe in a book in 1737 called The Whole Duty of a Woman.
That's so early.
Ooh. Yeah. That's whole with a W, by the way. Sorry. The entire duty of a woman.
So the later book, the 1747 Art of Cookery one, she does say specifically that a woman has written it in the title, which is pretty cool.
You can imagine the publisher having that conversation. Okay, so you want to write a book, but you're a woman. But it's going to be about cooking and cleaning. What do you think?
Love household it. Management.
Keep them inside those rooms.
We think they're probably called Yorkshire puddings because of the county's association with coal mining. And coal's associated with very high heats. And we cook Yorkshire puddings in very high heat.
Oh, that's tenuous as fuck. Yeah. Sorry. That's sweet. Are they called Yorkshire puddings?
That's one of the associations.
So they're not from Yorkshire?
I don't think so.
But that's like calling Weetabix Pacific breakfast because milk is wet. Like, I don't... that doesn't make it's really okay.
Well, maybe,
I'm disappointed that Yorkshire
didn't
invent the Yorkshire pudding.
You wanted a more romantic story, didn't you, about some like burly Yorkshireman?
Yeah, it's a Yorkshire puff in my
Hannah had a really, really big influence on Western cookery because she intentionally made this more famous book of hers, The Art of Cookery, like in plain language. So it was for, in her words, the lower sort. So kind of the servant class. Because cookery books until that point, say like The Form of Curry, as Jack mentioned, were written for royalty and people who were cooking at that kind of level and cooking in those kinds of houses. But she made a book that normal people could read.
Amazing.
And recipes that like had ingredients in them that were available to them and like a much simpler form. So she was like an immediate hit. Her book was a bestseller. It did really, really well. Hannah, unfortunately, she had a side hustle which bankrupted her. It was a clothes business which she ran with her daughter, and she ended up in debtor's prison.
Oh, God.
And then she was released, and she tried to write other cookbooks, like The Complete Confectioner, but they never did as well, and then she died poor, and we don't know what happened to her.
Goodness.
Yeah. I bet you she would have been fine if she was a man.
She was always butting against that glass ceiling, wasn't she?
Oh, no.
Cookbooks in 19th century America often rhymed. They would sell them for charity and they would make sure they rhymed. I found one for mince pies. It starts, "Our much respected Uncle Sam loves pies of pumpkin, fruit or jam, potato, apple, lemon, cherry, peach, plum and every kind of berry. But there are courtiers to the prince of pies, the old Virginia mince. There is but one right way to make it. Ere in its flaky crust you bake it. Use neither tongue nor other meat, as some cooks do, but boil the feet." And it goes on and on.
Wow. So that's the worst. So you end up with probably a badly cooked meal because they're compromising accuracy for the poem.
And nothing rises orange.
Yeah.
Also, if you're one of those people who follows a recipe like line by line, then you're right. Oh, wait, it's not before.
Exactly. Yeah.
How much is 4 and 20 ounces? Yeah. Just going back to the Yorkshire puddings for a second. In 1974, the Yorkshire pudding earned a protected status.
What?
Oh, wow. From the Royal Society of Chemistry, no less.
Oh, well,
don't really know
why
they were waiting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like they've got more pressing issues. But they
maybe
said
they were
that,
trying to make themselves a bit cooler.
They argued that a genuine Yorkshire pudding must raise at least 10 centimetres to
be an official
Yorkshire pudding. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I do wonder if maybe it's like baby bells. We don't actually eat baby bells, we eat mini baby bells. And I wonder if most of the Yorkshire puddings we eat, say from Aunt Bessie, they're probably mini Yorkshire puddings.
That is exactly right.
Yeah.
So a classic Yorkshire pudding is quite big.
Yes.
Okay.
The classic one, you kind of put your whole meal inside it, which is like the most fun ever.
Now the viral thing to do with Yorkshire puddings is to make a giant one, then like flatten it out, fill it with everything and roll it up
like a rat.
Oh my God.
Yeah, the Yorkshire burrito.
Is it good? Has anyone tried one?
I haven't, no.
You've answered your own question. It's not good.
So who is Aunt Bessie? Does she actually exist?
She's not real.
No.
I tell you this, yeah. They have a factory in Hull. They're based in Hull.
Yorkshire.
And they produce 900 million Yorkshire puddings every
year.
I don't know why they made
Imagine
that around billion.
The
but
smell of the Aunt Bessie's factory. It must be... actually, even I would agree that it probably smells quite nice.
Yeah.
In the run-up to Christmas alone, 110 million.
Oh, wow.
It's quite a lot.
Can I just say, I know it's Tekkers and you need a hot oven, but I make my own Yorkshire puddings and I really don't enjoy cooking. And if I can do it, you can also do it. Like,
that's our positive message of the day.
Very simple.
Believe in yourself. Don't that's burn the message yourself. Of our Christmas episode. Yeah.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
It's time for Lunchbox number 3, and this week that is from Manu.
I have bought fat-free Icelandic yogurt.
This is the worst Christmas ever.
I suppose it's kind of close to the North Pole.
Okay, the fat-free bit is because I couldn't find a full-fat version.
Okay, interesting.
But the Icelandic yogurt bit is important. So Skyr is a kind of yogurt that they eat over there. And I brought it because it is stolen. At Christmas time.
Stolen? Stolen. A whole different dessert.
Stolen flavoured yoghurt.
By one of the Yule lads. So we haven't really spoken about Yuletide yet, the idea of Yule. So we think it comes from the ancient Scandinavian traditions of winter solstice festivals. Mm-hmm. So Yule. So the Yule log, the Christmas cake that we actually know about.
Familiar with.
So that comes from the ancient tradition of burning an enormous log during the shortest days of the year, and then having a big feast and partying for as long as that log was burning. So that's kind of like the winter solstice traditions. Some people think it might have something to do with like Odin as well, because he was the god of the dead, and it might have been a Scandinavian Day of the Dead festival.
Whoa. So is Yule the Scandinavian sort of pre-Christ tradition for Christmas?
Yes. Okay, so like your festival. Yeah,
like the winter
and
festival.
It's fed into our modern day European Western Christmases. Okay, cool.
So when Christmas was Christianized and Catholicized, they kind of pulled in a lot of these more Scandi traditions in as well. And in Iceland, they have really specific Yuletide stories and mythologies and kind of like quirky traditions. And one of them is to do with the Yule lads.
Okay.
And sorry, this is a group of men.
It sounds like a WhatsApp group.
Actually,
a toxic WhatsApp group.
It really does. You'll like this. The Yule lads all have very weird, mischievous habits that are food related.
Okay.
The story begins with a fierce feminine figure.
Okay.
So an ogre called Girla.
wait, you buried the ogre bit.
Called Rosie McKean.
There's an ogre called Girla who is known for eating naughty children. She has like multiple heads and horns. Okay.
Is a weird food habit.
But she has 13 sons.
Okay.
And they come and visit you in the 13 days leading up to Christmas, and they tend to steal different types of food. So there's the first one who comes on the 12th of December. He likes to steal sheep and eat lamb.
Okay.
There's another one called Stubby who likes to swipe leftover food from frying pans.
Okay.
He's the smallest one, so he can only like reach.
Hence the name.
Yep. There's another called Pot Licker who likes to lick the leftovers of pots. There's a Bowl Licker. There's a Sausage Swiper.
Cool.
Sausage swiping is just like app dating.
Yeah, it's like app dating. That's so
true. But my favorite one was the spoon licker.
Nice.
So he comes and licks the leftover Skyr yogurt off your spoon.
Aww.
He loves it. So
he's really not getting many calories.
Pretty harmless to do that, right? Like,
it's not him stealing a live sheep. Yeah,
cleaning my spoons for me. How that happens, I don't care.
If you can survive your children being eaten and your flock being stolen, then you're kind of golden for the rest of the month.
Yeah. Well, that was also the thing. So there's part of the kind of mythology of it, and the ritual is to leave out different things for the different Yule lads as they visit you in the lead up to Christmas. So some families will leave out yogurt or sausages or like a lamb chop, and then they'll go missing. Kind of like, you know, when you leave cookies peas or carrots out for Santa and his reindeers. But if that all goes well and you've survived the visits from the Yule lads, you still need to make sure you are wearing new clothes. Otherwise, you might get eaten by a giant cat. So the ogre Grilla also has a pet cat called the Yule Cat.
How did they let this mythology get so out of control?
Were they all on mushrooms?
Maybe. It was Jesus. But the Yule Cat, if you think about it, there's a lot of links between kind of witches and paganism and cats. So it's not that mad. But what is mad is giant. It's the size of a house.
Okay.
And it roams the Icelandic countryside on Christmas Eve and it attacks kids that aren't wearing new clothes.
So actually, we're the lunchbox for this episode. We're
the ones being eaten most of this. Is anyone wearing new clothes?
How new's new? Like never
pretty,
worn before.
Yeah, like pretty new.
Within the return window. Within the return window. Right.
Yeah. 30 days. Yeah.
I think we should move on to our fourth and final lunchbox. And this week, that comes from Alex.
I have made for you a Christmas dessert. A serpentoni.
What? Serpentoni.
Sorry, I don't know what your reaction is, Rosie. It looks delicious.
It's stuck to the tray.
Yeah, okay. So
is it meant to be black? Is it a black mamba?
All right. Look, I really am at the end of my tether of this podcast, okay?
Really,
you have no idea how much production work is involved. Oh. I was up and making this at like 1 o'clock yesterday because I was doing edits. So I was sorting out kit.
I was going to say, I have also looked into this dessert.
Yeah.
And this is one of the prettier ones.
Thank you. There actually are some chockers out there. So this is a traditional festive dessert from Umbria. Especially from the town of Spoleto.
You've been there. I've been on holiday in Spoleto, guys. It's so nice.
Spoleto è bellissima.
And it is basically a long almond flour cake that you shape like a serpent, a snake, hence the name Serpentoni. It's usually filled with like almonds and nuts or honey, citrus, fruit, spices, liqueur. There's a lot of variations out there. It's kind of pretty simple, kind of fruity, biscuity, cakey thing. Mm-hmm. I actually did make a really nice shape. I just forgot that it obviously expands when you cook it, so it looked really nice when it was raw. I specifically came across this because I think it wasn't really well known as a tradition, and then it got some more attention a couple of years ago when an Umbrian family recipe appeared online. A woman in Montreal found a like decades old handwritten recipe from her grandmother's belongings, who I think was suffering from dementia, and posted it on Reddit asking for help with translation. Like, it was very difficult to read. They couldn't make any sense of it, and then like the online community managed to identify what it was and then like worked out the recipe, and then like people started trying to help make it, and this is actually any sort of results in a little revival of the cake.
It's like a Lazarus recipe.
Yeah, there's a really nice Atlas Obscura article about it. Nice. And so this is, I actually used this woman's recipe.
Amazing.
Incredible. I would love to try some.
Well, crack in.
I like the look of the glacé cherries.
Yeah, glacé cherries.
Heavy on the glacé cherries.
You know, one of the traditions is to lay your dough out on the tray and then you snip the dough with a pair of scissors to make scales, and then you decorate the snake with bits of dried fruit, and then you can use glacier cherries for the eyes, and like chop one in half and make a little forked tongue.
I've also seen in some decorations they pipe meringue scales
that's
like really 3D.
Why didn't you do that, Alex?
Yeah, lazy.
No, I swear, I'm going to walk, Rosie. You bought KFC.
That's a tribe from Rosie.
Rosie's making a variety of faces. She's gone through 5 stages
it's
of grief.
Not like the worst thing ever. I think if you had another crack at it, it'd be lovely.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it'd be quite fun also to like, I love these Christmas tradition that you can experiment with and evolve every year and make it a little more elaborate. Ooh. You get to revisit it each year, and you know.
See, we're all going back
I was like, oh, I don't know. And now I'm like, yes.
I quite like these caramelized glacé cherries. I'm actually going to finish this whole piece now.
Well done. See,
there you go.
It's really delicious. Thanks, Alex.
Yeah. You're clawing your way back into my favour. This is last lunchbox, so I wanted to make a dessert for you and talk a little bit about some Christmas desserts. According to that 2025 YouGov survey, which is just absolutely delivering the stats today, Christmas pudding is the top festive dessert in the UK.
As in most commonly seen at a Christmas dinner.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. 41% of us have Christmas pudding.
Vibe check on Christmas pudding around the table.
4 out of 10.
Hate it. 0 out of 10.
What?
Right. Why are you surprised? I can understand that it's an old English pudding that people love, and you know, fine, that makes sense.
This is what it is for me, and I think it's, I love something like Christmas pudding because of the tradition and the lighting. It's so special, and it is tasty, but I don't eat very much of it because it's incredibly rich and heavy and stodgy. But I only get to taste it once a year, so therefore that makes it special. Yeah.
Like, it's all about the tradition.
It's about everything around it. So
Christmas pudding is top. Right?
Christmas pudding, Christmas pudding 41%. Mince pies for 31%. So people, I guess, mince pies. Cream
fewer
for
than
pudding.
A third of people.
24% go for a savoury cheese board.
Oh,
fair enough.
I would say we do like all of them.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that's even pudding. I would say that's pudding. Yeah. But you know, Yule logs, trifles, Christmas cakes, 17 to 19%.
I'm waiting for my favourite one.
9% sticky toffee pudding. Is that your favourite?
No, sticky toffee pudding family.
It is good, but that's not my favourite.
What's your favourite?
Panettone.
So maybe it wasn't even listed. I don't know.
For shame. That is hands down my favourite thing about
Christmas. It's quite a posh thing, though, isn't it?
It's just like so light but so rich, and you can eat the whole thing.
It's like 50%. And butter, isn't it?
Yeah.
They hang them upside down after baking.
It's so it doesn't collapse.
That's the reason they do it. It doesn't collapse.
But I was like, how are they doing that? Because in the videos you watch, it's just like they flip the entire tray upside down and they don't fall off. And I'm like, what is happening? It skewers
in the bottom.
So it's like forks going into the bottom layer of the panettone.
I think that the dish that you have after your Christmas lunch.
Yeah.
Is Christmas pudding, sticky toffee pudding. Mm-hmm. Mince pies are peripheral and constant.
Yeah, we have them all December.
They're like every day, anytime you think, what's for pudding today? It's December, it's a mince pie.
Yes. But for me, so is panettone. Like, it's a panettone, Stollen, gingerbread, all the sweets. These are all things that you buy for the... Like, this is the beauty of Christmas, is that you do the big Christmas shop and you go absolutely fucking crazy.
Yeah.
And you buy, like, a sort of cake for the house that you'd never do. Like, it's like, and it's sitting there, and you can just have a slice when you get back.
Yeah,
and, like, you really... And so, yeah, I would say that's why it's really important that even Christmas cake, I would say, is something that you have with tea. If someone cooks it and makes it. Whereas for me, and there's something about Christmas pudding being... Like, Christmas pudding is Christmas pudding. It's like figgy pudding. It's like, it's the absolute, like, A-list dessert.
Yeah, true.
I don't think I could... It's a little bit like leaving the meat off or the roast potatoes. For me, the whole point is that you can't have Christmas without Christmas pudding.
And also, it's the centerpiece because it's lit on fire.
Yeah, exactly. It's got a whole thing going on. You can't light anything else on fire.
And it has a coin in it, doesn't it? And the
Let's talk about Christmas pudding, then.
Mm-hmm.
It's a descendant of something called plum pottage.
Pottage.
Okay.
Yep. A porridge.
Yeah.
No.
Everything in history is porridge.
And beer. Yeah. It came from the Middle Ages. It was a kind of rich, spiced mixture of boiled beef or boiled mutton.
Is that the same thing as frumenty? I looked it up. It had the name frumenty.
Yeah, I think it might be.
That's
a
fantastic name.
I know. Bring back frumenty.
Again, fruity meat pie. Kind of like mince pie. Everything was all year round, porridge and beer, and then fruity mince.
Fruity, spicy porridge.
The word plum could actually refer to any dried fruit, it wasn't specifically plums in the pie. And then by the 1500s, it was like tied to Christmas traditionally because dried fruit and spices were like a really Christmassy thing. So it was kind of perfect embodiment of that. And they got rid of the meat gradually, like dropped the meat again, just like mince pies.
It feels like every dish ever in British food initially had meat in it, and then eventually the meat dropped out.
Is that because these dishes become more accessible, as in poorer people start cooking them, and then meat gets less and less because meat is expensive?
I think meat and sugar go the opposite way, so sugar gets more cheap and more available, and then people decide, oh well, you know, why not make this sweet thing even sweeter? Also, the idea of dessert course, like, people used to eat service à la française, which is where you had all the dishes on the table at once. And then once service à la russe came in the 19th century,
which is
like eating
the courses
one by one. So you'd save all the sweet stuff for the end of the meal. And that's when you had the real distinction, I would say, between sweet and savoury.
That's interesting.
Okay. Mm. But that's because also if we're thinking about like the expensive food, apparently it's why Yorkshire puddings became a thing. That was initially a starter to fill you up. before you eat your main, so you eat less meat, which is expensive.
Anyway, so to finish off, by the time we get to the Victorian era, we've like got a solid Christmas pudding tradition, and they've got this thing called Stir Up Sunday. Have you heard about this?
Have you partaken
in Stir Up Sunday? Have you done that?
I've done it when I've been working for businesses that needed to do it.
It's the day when you make the mixture for the pudding, because you do this weeks in advance, and there's a ritual where every single member of the family gets a turn at stirring the pot.
You do it in November, and what you do is you stir up the mix. Oh, it's the mincemeat as well. You make your mincemeat for your mince pies on that day, and you soak it with the booze, and then you let it essentially ferment for as much time as it needs to ferment, and then you make your Christmas cake, and you make your Christmas pudding, and you make your mince pies, and your mincemeat is golden.
And of course, hiding things inside the Christmas pudding is a tradition all the way back to the 17th century, I think. It's not really done any more that commonly, I think, mainly because I think people buy their Christmas puddings and actually
you've gone mad.
When I was in France just briefly on New Year's Twelfth Night, I think, get a galette des rois.
Yeah, I was literally about to say.
You might know more about it then.
Well, basically, in France, they make a big pastry with an almond filling, delicious. And then there's like a little king in it, isn't there? And basically, if you get the slice of the king in, it's a small porcelain.
One of there are several different things you can put inside. There's obviously the silver coin where you get sixpence or something, and then like you get some money. You could hide a pea or a bean in, and that makes you king or queen of the feast if you get that.
That's more safe.
Bean king and the bean queen. It's like a whole dinner, kind of like a topsy-turvy dinner where you had poor people who would like pretend to be royalty.
That links to the bean feast. Saturnalia. The ancient Romans celebrated Saturnalia in the middle of December and towards the end, actually, because it extended for a week. And that was the only time of year that the enslaved people were given the chance to sort of be
the master for the
equals
day.
And master sometimes. Yeah.
You usually wonder how like seriously everyone took it. Given that the next day you'd wake up and be like, oh,
you could
I'm
easily like toe the line.
The other things that can be inside the that you might find inside the Christmas pudding, wishbone for good luck.
Salmonella.
A ring for impending marriage. I mean that's just a proposal. Yeah. But then also a thimble or button for thrift/spinsterhood, I found, which is like what is that? Like you get it, you're like, you're never gonna get married. So odd. So I looked into where our Christmas puddings come from, because I think nearly everyone probably buys a Christmas pudding these days. Making them is quite a lot of effort. Over 95% of Christmas puddings sold in Britain come from one company.
Yeah. Ooh. Is this Matthew something?
Matthew Walker.
Because it's such an unknown name.
It's so unknown. I've never heard of it. It's the world's oldest Christmas pudding maker as well.
Wow.
Founded in Derbyshire in 1899. This guy called Matthew Walker.
And he's still alive.
I know. He started selling puddings based on his mother's recipes. Okay. And then they got a dedicated factory in 1967. Produces 25 million puddings a year. Every single major UK retailer uses them. They've cornered the market in Christmas
pudding. I would love to be like his grandson, the CEO of Matthew Walker's Christmas puddings.
Division.
You've almost got a monopoly, and yet you're so under the radar famous. Like you just got to be a millionaire.
It's drummer in Coldplay for food.
Drummer in Coldplay for food.
So true.
Okay, that's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy.
Yes, you can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on X, Facebook, Instagram and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
You can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes and questions by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
Rosie, have you got any final festive tips to finish us off?
If you are making a Christmas dinner this year, all I can say is try and spread the load. Try and get some stuff done earlier in the week. You don't want to do all of your work on Christmas morning, A, because you want to get pissed, B, because it will stress you out.
There is a word, Yule Shard, which is somebody who is still preparing Christmas on Christmas Eve. So don't be a Yule Shard.
Don't be a Yule Shard.
And if you fancied it, in my book, Good Time Cooking, I have a Christmas feasting menu in there, and it's very good.
That is all from us. We'll be back with a little bonus episode, which we'll release on Christmas Day. From everyone at the Lunchbox Envy team, have a lovely Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, guys.
Happy Christmas.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Manu Onrio, Rosie McKean, Alex Bell, and me, Jack Chambers. This has been a quite interesting podcast.